This is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. The U.S. government says that it believes the individuals responsible for the terrorist attacks on September 11th were connected with a terrorist organization headed by a man named Osama bin Laden. This is the man that has also been implicated in bombings of two U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998, in which 224 people were killed. Also, it's believed that this network is responsible for the attack on the naval ship, the USS Cole, and may indeed have links to those individuals responsible for other attacks, perhaps even the very first attempt at the World Trade Center. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be trying to get a better understanding of Osama bin Laden, who he is and what his motivations are, and also perhaps try and put where we are right now and the events of September 11th into some sort of larger context that perhaps might make it a little bit easier to understand, and also to think about what the appropriate response should be. And our guest for this hour, Focus 580, is William Beeman. He's an associate professor of anthropology at Brown University, which is in Providence, Rhode Island. One of his interests, and he has many, is linguistics, language styles, and cultural patterns in the Middle East. He has studied countries in the Middle East, particularly Iran and the Persian Gulf. He has also written in recent years about the issues of fundamentalism and terrorism. For the past several years, he's been doing work in Tajikistan, where he's been in a position to monitor developments going on in Afghanistan. And we'll be talking this morning and try to ask some basic, straightforward questions. And as we do, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in with their own questions and comments. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief. And we ask that so that we can try to keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening to us this morning is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Beeman, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Not at all. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, first, perhaps we should talk specifically about Osama bin Laden and who he is. There are a number of things now, of course, we know about him, and now there's been more and more done to try to give people an understanding of who he is. Frontline featured an hour-long documentary last night on the subject.
Yeah.
So we know that he was born in Saudi Arabia into a very wealthy family that made its money in construction, benefited by ties to the ruling regime. Somebody who, it seems, when he was younger, lacked some direction in his life. But what provided that direction was his experiences in Afghanistan, fighting with those people who were resisting the invasion of the Soviet Union.
That is correct, and he was quite young at that time. He was 22, about the same age as many of the college seniors that you have there in Champaign-Urbana. His family actually comes originally from South Yemen, and they had come to Saudi Arabia and really were able to achieve their fortune there. Because of their ties to the oil industry, they also are quite cosmopolitan. In fact, I think that anybody who has had any dealings with the oil industry, including the family of George Bush and the family of Dick Cheney, have had dealings with the family of Osama bin Laden. As one of some 52 siblings, he is the 17th child of his father. And so is a, one would say, a middle child. And that is, that, as we know in most families, is a position of some ambiguity. Middle children are often likely to be rebellious and different from the rest of their siblings. So his experiences in Afghanistan at that very young age, in 1979, were obviously something that gave his life some real purpose.
And we know that in addition to, we're told that he was indeed involved militarily. He was involved in fighting there, but that also he was involved as a fundraiser, raising money to support the Afghan resistance. And in fact, this organization that now we've heard so much about, Al-Qaeda, apparently was formed back in 1988, and it was formed to generate funds and channel them to the Afghan resistance.
Yes, absolutely. As I say, because of his extensive ties outside of Afghanistan, which after all is a landlocked country and a country that didn't have very many foreign connections, he was invaluable to the people, the resistance fighters who were fighting the Soviet Union. And we also know, of course, that the United States itself was very instrumental in getting a large number of fighters from the Arab world into Afghanistan and placing them in a situation where they could serve as an effective resistance. Some of them, of course, were even trained in the United States. They were trained in Brooklyn by the CIA. At that time, many came from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, from other parts of the Arab world.
What I think here is the point now where a lot of people will have difficulty understanding what happened and why it is that he turned his attention on the United States in the way that he apparently did, is that here he was involved in an effort that we were supporting. We were allies in a war against the Soviet Union, a war which the Afghans won. Because they drove the Soviets out. And at that time, then apparently Osama bin Laden went back home. He went back to Saudi Arabia, and a lot of people saw him as a hero. So how is it that somebody who was involved on our side, people would say, how is it that somebody who was involved in our side in this fight that we supported now has become such an implacable enemy of the United States?
One of the problems that we have in the United States is that we have gotten in the habit, really during this century, of seeing the world in dichotomous terms. That is, if somebody is fighting on our side, then they are on our side as opposed to the other side. The Cold War, of course, was the principal dichotomous relationship that we had with the rest of the world. The world's nations were supposed to line up either on the communist side or on the American side. And nations like, for instance, India, that were interested in developing relations with both political spheres, were considered suspect and difficult. And the United States had, in fact, very difficult relations with India during this period of time. The Afghan resistance was very interesting. The United States had all kinds of reasons for wanting to make sure that the Soviet Union was not able to establish its influence in Afghanistan. And so we approached the resistance fighters and offered them this service in order to be able to resist the Soviets. At that time, they were quite clear with us. They said, all right, if you want to give us guns, if you want to give us trained fighters, that's fine, but don't expect us to be allied with you. And so they were quite happy to take our aid, but they were absolutely clear with us from the beginning that they were not particularly interested in a strong alliance with us. And so merely the fact that they were doing something that we also agreed with and we wanted them to do did not necessarily make them our friends. Mm.
Well, it certainly seems that this is a case, and there have been other cases in foreign policy where we have followed this philosophy that says our enemy's enemy is our friend. And it turns out that, in fact, in many cases, that's not true.
Well, that's exactly right. It's, frankly, quite naive on our part. We have a long, long habit in our foreign policy relations of trying to find plumbers, essentially people who will carry out our foreign policy objectives without having to commit U.S. troops or American lives directly to that application. We did this with the Shah of Iran in the 1970s, and of course the Shah was deposed by his own people, largely because of his close relationship with us, which was something that the more religious fundamentalist individuals in his country did not approve of. The same thing with Anwar Sadat. Many people, I think, make the mistake of saying that Anwar Sadat was assassinated because of his support of Israel. This is really a complete misunderstanding of the situation. Anwar Sadat was assassinated because of his close ties to the United States. And the U.S. objectives of supporting Israel were part of the mix, but his closeness to us was really the thing that that caused him to be assassinated. He was our plumber, and Saddam Hussein was in Iraq, did our bidding in the Iran-Iraq war because we did not want Iran after the Islamic Revolution to win that war. So Saddam Hussein took our arms and also the support that the CIA was able to give him in terms of logistics and intelligence information and fight Iran to a standstill in that war. What we've done continually is as soon as these individuals have done what we wanted them to do in the short term, we just walk away and abandon them. And the end result is that we are then surprised when they turn on us because they fundamentally did not agree with our philosophy or our long-term objectives, whatever they are, in the course of time. So this is a repeating pattern, and I think that in the situation with Osama bin Laden, we have precisely the same pattern being repeated again. In that, during the Soviet resistance, he was one of a number of plumbers. Once the Soviets were gone, then we were surprised to find that he was not in agreement with our military and political intervention in the region.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, William Beeman, he is Associate Professor of Anthropology at Brown University. It's in Rhode Island. He is interested in a number of things, language styles, performance genres. He's also written about societies, peasant and nomadic societies in the Middle East, particularly in Iran and the Persian Gulf region. Also Japan, Central America, and other places as well. And he's also done some writing on the subject of terrorism and fundamentalism. And recently he's been working in Tajikistan. And we're talking this morning about the context, the way that we try to understand what led to ultimately to the attacks that took place in New York and Washington, D.C. on the 11th of September. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Another part of this puzzle and something that people should have some appreciation of is that Osama bin Laden has grievances against other countries as well, including his own.
Absolutely.
And that also ties into, in part, it ties into the Gulf War, which draws in the United States, but there is, again, a larger sort of a context for that as well.
The historical context that causes individuals like Osama bin Laden also to oppose their own governments really goes back more than 150 years, maybe even 200 years. To just sum it up briefly for you, the Middle Eastern nations were arguably the most civilized nations on Earth. Last night we had a very interesting show with Bill Maher on Politically Incorrect, where Ann Coulter, who is otherwise an interesting individual with regard to U.S. constitutional law, revealed her extraordinary ignorance of Middle Eastern history by not understanding that Islamic nations from about the 8th to the 17th centuries were really far more civilized than European nations. The Industrial Revolution changed all that. The Industrial Revolution was a kind of like an economic and military cataclysm for the rest of the world. There was rapid development in Europe of superior military technology and superior economics. And this was an enormous challenge to Middle Eastern nations. The Great Britain, Russia, France started to essentially colonize and bite off huge chunks of the empires that had been established in the Middle East, and it threw the rulers there into panic. They hit upon a novel solution to try to solve their economic and military problems, and that was to sell off concessions in their own countries for the development of agricultural mineral rights, and other things to these European powers in exchange for cash, and partly for training in their for their military troops. The end result was that the rulers got wealthy, the Europeans got wealthy, but the people in these countries were left out in the cold. Their patrimony had been completely compromised. And this led to the establishment of the modern Islamic movement in about 1875 by an individual who is now known as the father of religious Islamic modernism, a man named Jalal al-Din al-Afghani, a figure we don't know in the West, but who is extremely important in the Middle East. Al-Afghani preached resistance to the European powers, also a need for the purification of Islam. And the third thing, he called for reform of Islamic law. Almost every Islamic resistance movement, including the Muslim Brotherhood and the Mujahideen of various sorts, are individuals who trace their pedigree back to Jalal al-Din, and Osama bin Laden is no exception. His agenda is really a 19th century agenda because the dynamics between the West and Middle Eastern nations have essentially not changed since that time. Hmm.
It seems to me that this is an important point for people to understand, that while one might talk about Osama bin Laden and his organization being rooted in the Afghan War, and also related to with influenced is involving the Gulf War, that what we're looking at here is something that fits into this larger context of popular uprising against what was perceived as Western Europe, mostly at that time, I guess, European imperialism, and perhaps also at that time against modernism.
Absolutely. Although I should point out that that there is no objection in the Islamic world, the Middle Eastern world, toward modern technology. That's never been an issue. The objections really come to have to do with perhaps modern sensibilities about behavior and about family life and about the role of women in society. So those are the issues that have some difficulties working their way into Islamic life. Although I will point out to you that in the Middle East in general, women in the Islamic world have made extraordinary strides, largely because they have been able to step up to the plate and assert their quite proper rights under Islam, rights to equal education and rights to participate in business and in government affairs. Their public conduct is the issue that usually is the issue of controversy, but their activities in social life and economic life have never been in question. They've always been guaranteed by Islam.
Well, we have a caller, and would certainly welcome others into the conversation if you have questions, comments. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. Also, of course, we do have that toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455, and that's toll-free, so the call will be on us. First caller in line here is local in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have a comment and a question. The comment is that I think also, rather than just focusing on the East or the Middle East reaction to the West, there is also a lot of internal and domestic unhappiness. For example, when you mentioned the Shah and you mentioned Sadat, you know, they were okay rulers for us. But what they did to their own people and how they ruled their country was a very big reason for dissatisfaction. So sometimes, you know, the United States or the United States government is happy with these dictatorial type of rulers for whatever they do as long as they go along with what we want. The second one is I have a question, and this relates to bin Laden and fundamentalism and what's gone on a couple of weeks ago. And this is that bin Laden is what I would call a Salafi. He looks at himself as a very strict Muslim, you know, following the pristine, uncorrupted Islam. And what I wondered was if anyone noticed these guys who they say, you know, they've got evidence who they were, who did the hijacking, you know, like were visiting strip clubs and drinking at bars. And I just thought that this, you know, I understand, okay, they might have shaved their beards and stuff, but if you look at these guys' activities right before they were going to kill themselves versus, say, the guys that they caught for the African bombings, it's, like, so different. And I'm just wondering if you see this as some kind of inconsistency.
Thanks very much for your comment. With regard to your first comment, maybe I should underscore again what I had just said, and that is that the pattern, the more than century-old pattern, has been a pattern of alliance between rulers and Europeans.
Sure.
And this is the thing that the Islamic movement was fighting against. So the rulers of these countries, you know, when they were in collaboration with outside powers, with European powers, were just as suspect as the outside powers.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the reasons why so many of these groups have turned to extra-governmental terrorist activities, because, in fact, they do not trust their own rulers. So the Shah and Sadat and the princess, the royal family in Saudi Arabia, fall very, very clearly into this pattern. They are not considered by these groups to be representing the best interests of their own people. Now, with regard to your second comment, this is a very complex question, and I think that it requires that we understand that. In the Islamic movement, the response of the Islamic movement, although it has an Islamic overlay to it, it really is an anti-colonialist response. And when we look at the vocabulary of the Islamic movement throughout the 20th century, we find that the vocabulary of this response is really drawn from from anti-colonial rhetoric rather than from specifically Islamic rhetoric. Just like, you know, in Islam, just like in Christianity or in Judaism, we have people who observe their religion or who are proud of their religion, but may not observe the letter of the religion. We have in the United States people who will tell you that they are culturally Catholic or they're culturally Jewish, but they in fact don't. If they're Catholic, they don't go to confession, or if they're Jewish, they don't attend temple. Maybe they have never even gone through bar mitzvah. So we can understand that there are individuals who identify closely with the religion and maybe even with the ideals of religion, but who don't practice it directly. And I think that there's been a you're of course quite correct that these individuals who are exhibiting this behavior were doing things which were quite profoundly non-Islamic. And it is it's important for us to understand that it is not necessary for individuals to identify with with something which goes under the general umbrella term Islamic movement and yet be very strict fundamentalist Muslims.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. I guess just to follow that for a second, it was my understanding that this, on their part, that this was a tactic, because what they were doing essentially was they were hiding in plain sight, and that they were told, not only were they told to avoid behaviors that would indicate that they were devout Muslims, that they were in fact supposed to practice behaviors that would say the opposite, that they were not devout Muslims.
I've heard this as a theory in Shia Islam, which is not the brand of Islam that these individuals follow. There is a doctrine of dissimulation that is used in cases where the faith is endangered. However, in Sunni Islam, this is not a doctrine that is generally followed. Although we do understand that as a military tactic, in underground movements everywhere, including, for instance, I'm brought to remember an important parallel in Japan, during the during the samurai period, where the samurai, in order to get revenge, were in order to get revenge on a person that had harmed their master and caused his execution, went underground and pretended to be dissipated and drunkards and so forth, and they waited the time until they could actually strike.
The 47 Ronin.
That's right, the 47 Ronin. So this is something that is, I guess, well known as a tactic for anybody who's involved in underground activities. But what I wanted to point out was that in the 19th century, the Islamic movement was characterized as an Islamic movement by its founders, largely because Islam was the only thing that really united all of the people in the Middle East who were suffering from this colonial dynamic, where they were put at a disadvantage. We have many groups within Islam, Shia, Sunni. We have many various ethnic groups, Iranians who are New Europeans versus the Arabs who are Semitic, and to find something that would allow these groups to have a common cause, Islam was the only unifying principle.
We are at our midpoint here. We have a couple of callers, and we have somebody on a cell phone I will get right to. Our guest is William Beeman. He's professor of anthropology at Brown University, which is in Providence, Rhode Island, and has done research on different sorts of things, including performance styles, language styles in the Middle East. He's done work on societies in the Middle East, particularly in Iran and in the Persian Gulf, has also done some writing on the issues of terrorism and fundamentalism. And for the past couple of years has been doing work in Tajikistan, from which he's been able to have some closer perspective on what's been going on in Afghanistan. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's our cell phone caller in Chicago. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. How you doing?
Good, thanks.
You know, it's so nice to hear the gentleman from Brown University, because you're always getting this one-sided, ignorant view of what is going on in the world. How can one get in touch with this gentleman?
It's very easy to get in touch with me. I'm at Brown University. If you go to the Brown University website and go to the anthropology department, you'll find I have a website there. My email is very easy to find.
Okay.
I'd be delighted to correspond with any of your listeners.
Yeah, and I am, you know, WILL, you guys just don't know what you're doing for this community that can hear you, because the guest that's on here is so sober that you can, you know, really learn something from people like you, and I really appreciate you. And that's my comment. I will be emailing you, sir.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Let's continue. We have a caller here up next in Aurora, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, I'll make some questions and comments, and then I'll hang up, and you can answer as you want to. Do any of the Middle East countries have democracy as we know it? Why do we only see pictures of a barren land in Afghanistan? I have never seen a picture of the capital. And why does what does Afghanistan export to bring in any monies? I realize they're a very poor country, but what do they trade to get any monies? And do many of the Afghan people migrate to this country? Thank you.
All right. We can work backwards, I guess, from talking about Afghanistan. How you want to talk a little bit about, from your perspective, what's been going on in Afghanistan the last few years?
Certainly. To answer the very last question, I am very sorry to have to tell the audience who doesn't know about this that one of the principal exports from Afghanistan is drugs, heroin in particular. Afghanistan, during the time that the resistance fighters were fighting the Soviet Union, needed cash, and they began to cultivate opium poppies as a very lucrative kind of cash crop. We were also complicit in this. The United States was. We had a. We knew that this was a potential danger both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. But as the price for cooperation in fighting the Soviet Union, the United States drug enforcement officials, the CIA, the people who were involved with that, absolutely stopped enforcing any kind of restrictions against the cultivation or the export of opium. And the end result has been that there has been an enormous drug trade coming out of heroin factories that have been established in Afghanistan. This was done also with the complete compliance of the Taliban, who benefit directly from the economics that's resulted from this. The opium is the heroin is exported generally through the mountainous regions of the Pamirs to the city of Osh in Kyrgyzstan, where it moves to Moscow and other locations in Russia and also to China, and eventually reaches the world market. During the last year, the United States put pressure on the Taliban to shut down these factories, and they did, but they had so much heroin stockpiled that the trade has never been stopped. So it is a tremendous blight on the Afghan people, many of whom don't have anything to eat, and they have become, many of them, drug addicts as a result of their lack of food. So rather than eat, the drugs are readily available, and they've just become addicted to heroin. This is one of the reasons why the idea of bombing Afghanistan back to the Stone Age or inflicting more harm on these poor people is, I think, rather obscene on the part of the United States. Now, with regard to democracies in the Middle East, it is extremely important that all of your listeners understand that, for the most part, the nations of the region are nations that were not created by the people who lived in those nations. They were mostly created by the European powers after World War I, when the Ottoman Empire joined the Axis powers in World War I, and the Axis powers, of course, lost the war. Great Britain and France essentially carved up the region into nations that had never before existed in exactly the form that they exist today. Some of these nations were created in an extraordinarily cynical manner. For instance, Kuwait, which we've had difficulty with, was largely created in order to protect British oil interests in the Persian Gulf. Iraq was cobbled together between a large Shia community, a Sunni community, and a Kurdish community, and the British installed a king who was the son of the religious leader, the Grand Mufti of Mecca. The Mufti of Mecca had two sons, however, and so each of them wanted a kingdom. So the British created Jordan out of whole cloth. It was never in a place that ever existed before, and installed the Mufti's second son as the king of Jordan, and the royal family of Jordan is still there today, even though they are not from the region, they're from Saudi Arabia. Syria and Lebanon were created by the French in a similar manner. Lebanon in particular was created in order to give a homeland to the Maronite Christians, whom the French had a special interest in. So when we talk about the nations of the region, they have been, throughout this entire century, working their way out of a mess that was created by the European powers, who never expected there to be conflict in the region because they would always have their armies stationed there. After World War II, they could no longer afford the armies in the region, and they withdrew, and this left the United States as the sole Western power in the region. And the conflicts, the internal conflicts with these nations, have led to dictatorships and other kinds of difficulties. But to blame the people of the region for somehow not being enlightened and not being democratic is an enormously unfair judgment on the people of the region. They were saddled with a colonial legacy that was almost impossible, and they have done really, I think, an extraordinary job in trying to create a normal life for themselves. Mm.
Just and to go back to one other point that the caller made, I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but I think it is important for people to appreciate the fact that just what condition Afghanistan is in today, and just to what extent the country has been devastated by two decades of war, first war against the Soviets and then civil war, and that as a result, it is at this moment probably one of the poorest, most disadvantaged nations on earth.
Well, Afghanistan is a territory or a nation that was essentially created as a result of an agreement between Great Britain and Russia. The great game in this region had to do with India and the Russian territories in Central Asia. And both sides in the 19th century in particular were afraid that the other side was going to encroach on their colonial territories. And so Afghanistan was created as a buffer state between the two. It has never been a nation state in the true sense of the word. It was a residual territory. And as a result, the nation has never really coalesced into a nation state that would have a kind of a national sensibility. There are the Taliban essentially are Pakistani. They were created in Pakistan. They are they're the Pushtun ethnic group, which exists partly in Pakistan and partly in Afghanistan. Over and opposed to them, the group of the Northern Alliance are Tajik. They're more closely allied with Iran. They speak Persian, and the third main group in the country are the Baluchis in the south, and the Uzbeks, a Turkish-speaking group in the north. None of these groups have ever really identified with the nation as a whole. They've had more or less a separate existence, and Afghanistan is truly a loose confederation of ethnic groups.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is William Beeman. He's professor of anthropology at Brown University. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller in line is in Champaign on line 1. Hello.
Hello. I'd just like to second the earlier caller's comment about what a great program this is and the other great programs you guys have had over the last few weeks. I had a couple comments, and then I'll ask a question. And my first comment is that the reference to the drug trade is very appropriate. But I think to say that the CIA and the DEA just sort of politely ignored what was going on understates the probable facts, which we won't know because all the materials are classified and will be for some time. But everywhere there has been a major drug problem in the last probably 30 years. The CIA seems to have had some hand in it, whether it was the Golden Triangle during Vietnam or in South and Central America with cocaine and the tyrants or the thugs that we put in power, like the Noriegas of the world, that we eventually had to come back and deal with, just the way we had to deal with Saddam and now Bin Laden. So I think probably the CIA, which, you know, if you call Iran-Contra as well, that was also drug-related. You know, it's a very handy way to make money, as you mentioned, but to say that the CIA just sort of ignored it and didn't sort of try and stop it is understating the case. I think they probably had a much more active role. And after 10 years of Soviet bombing, you can't really blame the Afghanis for trying to generate a little hard cash somehow because they've got nothing left. I mean, the reason why that woman sees pictures of barren landscapes is because an already harsh climate and topographical area has just been annihilated by the Russians, who used everything from conventional munitions to biological and chemical weapons. So, I mean, you know, the thought of bombing them, as you mentioned, is reprehensible. I can't even caution or think about that. I think that would be just a huge mistake, and it would achieve nothing. My question is, I'm glad you talked a little bit about the ethnic groups I was curious to know, they talk about Pashto speaking groups. Are those the same, or are they related to the Pathan groups in
Pakistan? Yes, they're the same group.
In Pakistan? Okay.
Same group.
And the related question is, do you think, well, I mean, probably so, but to what extent has this incredible conflict that the region has seen really destroyed any hope of sort of centralized government that might have been in place, in much the same way that it happened in Cambodia in the 60s when you had the Khmer Rouge come about after we basically dropped, you know, millions of tonnage on Cambodia and wiped out any chance that they had to sort of get their self in any sense of order. And then you had this horrible regime come in which really didn't care at all about their own population. They were just concerned with keeping a ruling cadre well-fed and in power. And it strikes me that the Taliban is similar, and you could make the same case probably about what's going on in North Korea. We don't hear much about that, but it's a similar situation. The people are starving, but the elites and the military are in control. So if you could speak to that, I would appreciate it. Thanks. Bye.
Okay.
I agree with the caller that my suspicions are that the CIA had a much more active role in promoting the drug trade. I have no proof of it, however, only rumors. So when I was talking about the drug trade, I stated the most conservative position that I could, and certainly we did nothing to stop it. And it is, poppies are one of the things that, in fact, grow in Afghanistan, and they don't require a lot of water, and so they can even go through a drought period. Very, very high cash crop. The idea of getting a central government in Afghanistan is going to be very difficult. There's been a recent call for a Loya Jirga, which is a grand conclave of various tribal groups in Afghanistan. It's been used in the past by the former king of Afghanistan, Zahir Shah, who is in fact still alive and still in exile, and has offered himself as a possible uniter of the country. I frankly don't hold out much hope for that, but it is the way that there will be a centralized government if the various groups can come together in a conclave where they can finally get some agreement about unity within the nation. But the Taliban are viewed by most of the people in Afghanistan as a foreign invasion. They are viewed as Pakistanis, and they are not viewed as native Afghans, even though many of them may be Afghan by birth or by origin. So it is they really lack legitimacy within their own country.
Let's go on. The next caller here was someone on the campus. It's our line number two. Hello.
Hi. Line two?
Yes.
Okay. There's so many things I want to say, but the history you gave of the region was very interesting, and I wanted to point out something that I think any American that grew up in this century cannot imagine. And we were all brought up with the idea of self-determination being the founding principle of our country. You know, taxation without representation was what started the revolution that broke us away from Great Britain. And I don't think any American can imagine what it is like to grow up in a country where the government that you have is determined by some other country. And when it came out that possibly Chinese donations were made to the Democratic Party, there was a furor like you couldn't believe, because that was just, we can't have that, some other country donating to our political parties. And yet, whether or not you believe it's really true that we determine the government in other countries, the people who grow up there believe it. For example, Iranians are so cynical that many of them believed, after the revolution that brought Khomeini back, that they still had the government that the U.S. let them have. And I just think Americans should try to imagine what that must be like.
You're completely correct. The United States, of course, installed or reinstalled the Shah in 1953 after there was a nationalist movement that caused the Shah to go into exile. It's a completely documented fact. The CIA organized street demonstrations and other kinds of activity within the country that deposed the nationalist government and reinstalled the Shah. So it's quite natural that the people of Iran would have had the very interesting notion that the United States was also installing Khomeini. And the logic here is actually the same logic that is involved with the resistance movement in Afghanistan. That is that the United States was certain, or the people who claim this say that the United States was certain that with a strong Islamic government that this government would be anti-communist. And so therefore they preferred to have an anti-communist fundamentalist Islamic government nationalist or otherwise democratically elected government that would not do what the United States wanted it to do. Of course, this is a fantasy. The idea that the United States installed Khomeini is really a little bit beyond the pale. But you can understand the habits of thought that people have developed as a result of this continual interference on the part of European powers, including the United States, in the affairs of the region.
We are at the point here where we just about have to stop. And my apologies, we have some callers we can't take. What I would like to do at least is to give you a minute here to answer what is now the big and difficult and maybe almost unanswerable question is, now at this point, what do we do?
Well, one of the things that we have to remember is that the United States actually, despite the counter-coup in Iran and an incursion that we made in 1958 in Lebanon, the United States actually, before the British pulled out of the region in 1972, actually enjoyed rather excellent relations with most of the nations in the region. And it is not inevitable that we should be in conflict with these nations because we have an existence proof. We know that we did have good relations at one point. And it was before we really started to muck around in the political and military affairs of the region, before we started to establish our military troops in the area. So it is really important that we sit down and re-examine our political and economic and military strategies for the entire region. Eventually, I think that the United States has no business in the Middle East. We have no business trying to determine people's political futures, nor do we have any business having troops stationed there. The world has matured, and we no longer are dependent on the oil resources of the Middle East because there's so many other markets. And the nations of the region, I think, are quite capable of handling their own affairs. And if we would withdraw gradually from the region and perhaps fully internationalize any police keeping forces that are needed to take care of individuals like, for instance, Saddam Hussein, we would take ourselves out of the line of fire. And that is, we should be asking ourselves, why aren't terrorists bombing Trafalgar Square or the Reichstag in Berlin or bombing Rome? They're not because our European allies are not in the line of fire. They are not perceived as having this interfering set of political and military relations.
We must leave it at that. Professor Beeman, thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Delighted to be with you.
Our guest, William Beeman, he's professor of anthropology at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island.